I remember, for example, when the ex-Attorney General, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn with which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president. What is dangerous here is a turning away from anything any white American says. The reason for the political hesitation and the spite of the Johnson landslide is that one has been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know, and neither does Martin Luther King, none of us know, how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say.
Writer and civil rights campaigner James Baldwin speaking at Cambridge University in 1965. The Oscar-nominated new film I Am Not Your Negro gives his words astonishing new life while prompting some uncomfortable questions about just where we are right now. We'll sit down for a special extended interview with its director, Raoul Peck, today on The Cinema Show.
You know, when you are on the side of the winner, when you are the one writing the narrative, of course, you want to reject or deny everything that counter that narrative. You don't want to see that. And you can say that with a good heart.
Debate. James Baldwin versus William Buckley. Subject. Has the American dream been achieved at the expense of the American Negro? This debate was held recently at the Cambridge Union, Cambridge University, England, and was recorded for use by...
When James Baldwin sat down to begin work on a book about the American civil rights leaders, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and Martin Luther King, he couldn't have possibly imagined the context in which his words would one day be heard. The new documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, is assembled entirely out of Baldwin's words, largely from that unfinished book, but also letters and other words interspersed with actual footage of the man himself. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. The result of Raoul Peck's new film is a striking dual personality that feels both monumental and deeply intimate. There's the James Baldwin that we see, calm, considered, ferociously intelligent, and possessing a rare talent for communicating complex ideas. But then there's the Baldwin that we hear, his words given life in the form of a voiceover by Samuel L. Jackson.
To J. Acton, Spartan Literary Agency, June 30th, 1979. My dear J., I'll confess to you that I am writing the enclosed proposal in a somewhat divided frame of mind.
To bear witness to this film isn't to merely learn about the struggle of the civil rights movement. As admirable an aim that would be, director Raoul Peck has achieved something far more profound. Watching I Am Not Your Negro is to feel the presence of James Baldwin, as if his spirit, lost with all its knowledge and careful observations, has somehow returned to deliver what can only be the smallest snapshot of his life and experiences.
And in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white. And since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover that the flag to which you have pledged allegiance along with everybody else has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you. It comes as a great shock to discover that the country which is your birthplace and to which you owe your life and your identity has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you.
On the day that James Baldwin stood in front of all those students at Cambridge University, he couldn't have possibly imagined the ascendancy of Barack Obama to the presidency, or the race riots and entrenched inequality that always seems more and more ingrained. Nor could he have envisioned a revival of white nationalism and the casual, confident racism flaunted by President Obama's successor. Baldwin's extraordinary achievement comes from his words, a style of prose that encourages the reader to explore harsh truths. Raoul Peck wisely leaves those words untouched. What remains is a film for now, something so perfectly of its time, yet still just an introduction to something so much larger. For the director, Raoul Peck, the decision to construct the film entirely from the words of James Baldwin came quite early, and it all stemmed from a sense that younger audiences are beginning to lose sight of just who James Baldwin really was.
At the start of the project, I gave myself a certain number of rules. The idea was, how do I bring Baldwin back to a younger audience today? Because over the years, I've seen how Baldwin have been disappearing, and a lot of people don't even know who James Baldwin was. So the project was from the start, you know, how can I have Baldwin play the same role he played in my life? Meaning, you know, help me structure my thoughts, help me understanding who I was and what the world around me was and how to deconstruct that world and find my own story and my own narrative. So I had to find a way artistically, cinematically, to bring those words and only those words without any talking heads, without any scholar explaining who Baldwin was. And by the way, it wasn't supposed to be a biography. It was really about the words.
I'll tell you a story, if I may. Many years ago, when I first came to London, I was in the British Museum, naturally. One of the West Indians who worked there struck up a conversation with me and wanted to know where I was from. And I told him I was from Harlem. And that answer didn't satisfy him. And I didn't understand what he meant. I was born in Harlem. I was born in Harlem Hospital, I said. I was born in New York. None of these answers satisfied him. He said, where was your mother born? And I said, she was born in Maryland. And I could see, though I didn't understand it, that he was going more and more disgusted with me. He was so became more and more impatient. And where was your father born? My father was born in New Orleans. Yes, he said, but man, where were you born? And then I began to get it. No, I said, well, I said, my mother was born in Maryland, my father was born in New Orleans, I was born in New York. He said, but before that, where were you born? And I had to say, I don't know. I could see that he did not believe me. I tried to explain, there's no way for me. He said, don't you care enough to find out? And I tried to explain that if I were originally from Dakar or from wherever I was in Africa, I couldn't find out where it was because my entry into America is a bill of sale.
It had to be pure Baldwin, and at the same time, it had to be a complete work in itself.
But there are so many other people, such as James Baldwin, that are also part of this story. And I know in the film you reference people like Eartha Kitt. So many people stood out for their own specific reasons. For you personally, because I know you just mentioned there that Baldwin had an impact on you, he was important to you. What was it about Baldwin that stands out? He obviously has a way with words, but there's something else about him, isn't it? When he talks, when he animates, there's something very different about him.
Don't forget, Baldwin at his core is really an incredible humanist and a philosopher, a poet. He's somebody, you know, for which bodies and soul are important. So the way he engages with you is always in a very direct, sincere, and loving way. And he have been not only the good friend of many of those people fighting in the civil rights, but he have also been the mentor for a whole generation. You know, people like Nina Simone, people like Maya Angelou, people even like Toni Morrison later on. You know, he was really the elder. He was somebody you could rely on. He was somebody who was always there with the right word. And his friendship with Sidney Poitier, his friendship with Harry Belafonte, all those people, his friendship with Marlon Brando, you know, they have known each other even before they were both famous. And those friendships were eternal. Baldwin is somebody who was always felt faithful to those friendship. You know, the Bill Miller, the teacher that he talks about in the film that brought him to cinema when he was 10 to see films. I got a letter from her son who went to see the film and wrote to us, and he told me a story about Baldwin visiting his mother when his mother was old and a few months before she died, and how Baldwin just show up in the doorstep and spent 2 hours hand in hand with his mother in a corner of the living room, talking to each other as they have been friends all their lives. You know, so Baldwin was such a man. He would just drop out and drop in and visit you because, you know, he didn't see you for a few years and he wanted to spend some time with you. So that's why he's care for you. And he can tell you the hardest things, which he does in the film, but you just take it because somehow you know it's true. You know, and he's not saying it to be aggressive towards you. He's telling you almost to save you, you know, like telling you, you need to know the truth in order to save yourself, in order to build your future on a, you know, more solid basis. And that's, you can't resist, you know.
Now, when you were starting out as a writer, you were black, impoverished, homosexual. You must have said to yourself, gee, how disadvantaged can I get?
Oh, no, I thought I hit the jackpot.
Oh, great.
It was so outrageous you could not go any further, you know. It had to be, so you had to find a way to use it.
Discussing the concept of race in America often carries a sense of trepidation. But the experience of I Am Not Your Negro is far from combative. Regardless of how liberal-minded you might feel, however, there are some moments that will force you to stop and consider your own thoughts and actions. We'll hear more from Raoul Peck and the concept of white innocence soon. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. James Baldwin inhabited a fairly enviable circle during his lifetime. From Harry Belafonte to Sammy Davis Jr., his contact book almost reads like a list of legends.
Well, if I were going to be a controversial personality, and that was my aim, and that I constructed all my behavior and arranged situations to conform to that objective, I would be awfully silly to admit it here.
It's little wonder, then, that Marlon Brando would want to be part of Baldwin's world. He'd been politically active since very early in his career and even took part in the 1963 March on Washington alongside James Garner, Charlton Heston, Burt Lancaster and Sidney Poitier. In 1968, Brando announced that he would not be starring in what had intended to be his next film, The Arrangement, and would instead be dedicating himself to the civil rights movement.
Mr. Brando, have you been on this road for a long time?
I don't know. There was a time when nobody was on the road, really. There was a time when Rosa Parks stood up in a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. And from that date, the Montgomery bus boycott took place. And somewhere in the 50s, 18 Negroes in a Georgia prison camp broke their legs with sledgehammers to bring attention to the condition that they were in. And slowly, bit by bit, I became involved in this issue, and I guess my springboard was listening to Martin Luther King speak about the woe and distress in California.
Of course, the politics of Marlon Brando wasn't without its share of critics. Shortly after his much-hyped role in 1978's Superman, Brando criticized the Jewish filmmaking community for what he saw as the allowance of certain stereotypes to creep into films, while similar depictions of Jewish people were off limits. Years later, he met with Jewish leaders and apologized for the remarks. The rabbi, Marvin Heyer, told Reuters that Brando was in such an emotional state that it took about 45 seconds for him to compose himself. If Brando's sentiments weren't always expressed quite so clearly, for the most part, he held the greater good at heart. This week would have been Marlon Brando's 93rd birthday, and movie subscribers here in the United Kingdom can catch the 1966 drama The Chase, starring Brando alongside Jane Fonda and Robert Redford, and his landmark 1953 film The Wild One, featuring Brando's culture-defining performance as biker, Johnny Strabler. Sample a whole month of MUBI right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Raoul Peck's film is filled with archival material that adds an extra illustrative edge to the writer's prose. But the addition of one particular Hollywood legend might catch a few people by surprise.
So on behalf of the board of directors of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, I proudly present you the C.B. DeMille Award to Miss Doris Day.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Clint. I don't know what to say. I really don't. I'm a wreck. You do this all the time, and I don't do it anymore. I live in the country, and I've got to come to town more often.
But what does Doris Day have to do with James Baldwin? Well, directly, not very much. It's important to note that Doris Day is probably one of the more misunderstood American screen stars. Her reputation as the nation's most famous housewife often obscures her more progressive roles. Alas, that famous persona has seen her sometimes aligned with what Baldwin and Raoul Peck refer to as white innocence.
It's a lovely day today, so whatever you...
It's interesting the way you depicted the concept of something called white innocence in the film. There were some shots of Doris Day, which coincided with some of the comments that Baldwin had written. Can you talk to me about what is white innocence? Can you explain the concept of that and elaborate on a little bit of why Baldwin decided to use the films of Doris Day as a way to make an example of white innocence was for him during his time?
I didn't coin the concept of white, and in fact I don't use it because I'm not pretty sure of what it means. What I see has more to do with the fact that if you're born in a certain class, you're bound to reproduce all the elements of your class. If you're born in a poor neighborhood, there is a great chance that you will stay poor because you will go to a bad school. You will have problem to concentrate when you go home at night because eventually your parents are fighting over problems that they have to solve, etc. So it's a whole circle that it's very tough to break. And of course there are exceptions, and usually the good people are using those exceptions to say, well, you know, if you really work hard, you can make it. But that's a folly. That's a total, mirage that people tell you so in order for you to accept your conditions. And if you are born in a rich family and in a rich class, there is, you have access to the best school, you have access to comfort, you have access to time, to all sort of help that really will help you become a good citizen. Yes, it is just the lack of empathy. That's what Baldwin calls it. A lack of empathy toward the others. That is not like you, that did not have the same chance as you. And because you are on the good side, what you could call the good side, you don't have to worry about whatever is happening on the other side of the wall. And that can go, very far, where you can't avoid to see that the people are being killed. So it's a reality, and it's that reality reflects also in cinema. And that's what Baldwin, have managed to deconstruct. the fact that Hollywood movies are also transporting that innocence, and which I call also ignorance, which is a more precise term to it, because in my own life, I am born in Haiti, I grew up partly in Haiti, and then in Congo, and then in France, and then in the United States, and then in Germany, and all those places. I had to learn the story and the culture of those countries, and I know them very well, and I know my own as well. I know that it's possible, that it's just the way that you become concerned about the life of other peoples and the reality of other people. But you can also, as well, live a pretty perfect life without having to have that kind of empathy. And that's what Baldwin is denouncing, and what the film somehow also tells you, you know, you cannot pretend to be innocent anymore. You know, the facts are on the table. And as Baldwin says, you know, now it's a question, what are you going to do? Because you are your history, and whatever will happen, you will have your part. You know, whether you decide to do something or to do nothing, the result will be on your shoulders as well. Because we are living in a time where we cannot pretend to be innocent. You know, that's the sheer reality.
I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, that the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal for me about a Christian nation. It means that I can't afford to trust most white Christians and certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto. I don't know if the Board of Education hates black people, but I know the textbooks I give my children to read and the schools that we have to go to. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
They seem to have a bit of a confrontation, and perhaps Paul Weiss's motives were completely innocent, but the way it came across was very condescending. And I don't think he was meaning to be condescending, but that's exactly how it came across.
All this emphasis upon black men and white does emphasize something which is here, but it emphasizes it, or perhaps exaggerates it, and therefore makes us put people together in groups which they ought not to be in. I have more in common with a black scholar than I have with a white man who is against scholarship. And you have more in common with a white author than you have with someone who's against all literature. So why must we always concentrate on color or on religion or this? There are other ways of connecting men.
I'll tell you this. When I left this country in 1948, I left this country for one reason only, one reason. I didn't care where I went. I might have gone to Hong Kong, I might have gone to Timbuktu, I ended up in Paris, on the streets of Paris, with $40 in my pocket on the theory that nothing worse could happen to me there than it already happened to me here. You talk about making it as a writer by yourself, you had to be able then to turn up all the antenna with which you live, because once you turn your back on this society, you may die. You may die. And it's very hard to sit at a typewriter and concentrate on that if you're afraid of the world around you.
Do you think we too often have this knee-jerk reaction to maybe not listen to those who have experienced things firsthand? Because even though that was the 1960s, I was reading an article in the New York Times just today where they referenced that there was an article about race, and then a reader had written in asking why everything needs to be about race. There are other things that we can connect with. It was almost word for word what Paul Weiss had said on this program. Is that still a problem that's this incredibly common, perhaps just as common as it was during Baldwin's time?
That part of the film rang very true to me. That's those are things that I hear every day, still today. You know, it's a sort of a good conscience of, you know, when you are on the side of the winner, when you are the one writing the narrative, of course you want to reject or deny everything that counter that narrative. You don't want to see that. And you can say that with a good heart. You know, why do you have to frame everything through race? Indeed, there are other things, but if you don't let me have access to those other things, you know, if I'm confronted day in, day out with the reality of my skin, You know, and you can say the same about women. You know, as a woman, there is no way you can not see that you are a woman just walking in the street. The thoughts you have to bring, you know, are you wearing a shirt or a skirt or pants? You have to think about that decision before going into the street. And this is not something you can shed, you know, and leave at home. This is permanent. You know, do you go inside an elevator with five strong men and who you don't know? Those are not things you can, you know, say, oh, let me forget for 5 seconds that I'm not a woman. That's not the reality. And that's the same for if you are black in a white world or if you are Chinese in a white world, etc. You know, and it just goes beyond the respective color. It's ultimately it's about the other. You know, you are always the other of a majority of people wherever you are. So, and it's about that empathy as well. And when you are on the good side, on the winner side, on the side who have the power, you can, of course, use those words, you know, how come you're not more relaxed? How come you are always angry? Well, guess what? I have reason to be angry every day.
There's going to be a Negro president in this country.
There never will be a Negro president in this country. Why do you say that?
We can't get jobs. How are we going to be a president?
Got it. But I want you to think about this, that there will be a Negro president of this country, but it will not be the country that we are sitting in now. But if you say to yourself that there never will be a Negro president of this country, then what you're doing is agreeing with white people who say you are inferior. It's not important, really, to know whether or not there's a Negro president. I mean, in that way. What's important is that you should realize that you can become the president. There's nothing anybody can do that you can't do.
Raoul Peck's Oscar-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro is out now in the UK, Spain, and Ireland.
When I walk into a church, I only see paintings of white angels.
Today's show was mixed and edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. The Cinema Show returns next week. Among those inhabiting James Baldwin's circle was the actress and singer Eartha Kitt. Like many of her friends, Kitt was no stranger to political controversy. She was a proud civil rights campaigner and feminist, and an outspoken supporter of the LGBT community too. We'll leave you now with her rendition of Angelitos Negros. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening. Paint me some black angels now. Some black